Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm in the studio with Chris Weingarten, Brendan Klinkenberg, and Simon Vosick-Levinson. And we're going to talk about the latest hip-hop beef, which is a pretty intense one, Pusha T versus Drake. So who wants to sum up kind of how we got where we got to in this Drake versus Pusha T battle?
I can take this one. Basically, Pusha T and Drake have been sending each other shots for years now. And it's kind of one of those rap fan like fantasy beefs where you're like, this one would be fun to watch. Pusha, on his album Daytona, the last track, Infrared, is kind of a long but subdued shot at Drake, expressing like the same things people always express when they want to come at Drake, which is centered around ghostwriting and kind of not being a rapper's rapper, which Pusha T is. Drake didn't take kindly to that and released a song called Duppy Freestyle that came out, I think, just a day after Daytona officially dropped. But obviously people had been hearing Daytona for the full week. Like, the rumors had been started that Pusha was coming for Drake, and Drake dropped a like straight up diss track, the first like open shot that's been fired in this this battle. And then Pusha dropped another diss track, which was
a nuclear.
Yeah, it was a real escalation. it was something that there's no way Drake expected that to be the response. But Pusha basically functioned as an investigative reporter. He dug up a lot of stuff about Drake and said on record that Drake has a child who he won't see. And it blew the internet up. It's all anyone's talked about since.
It wasn't very nice.
It was not nice. It was surgical. Like, I haven't seen a diss track like that in a
decades. It's been a really
anyone's done a diss track that has worked that ruthlessly.
Truly disrespectful. So let's maybe start by hearing a little bit of Infrared.
How could you ever write these wrongs when you don't even write your songs? But let us all play along. We all know what niggas for real been waiting on. Push.
And then let's hear Drake's response, Duppy Freestyle.
Yeah. Your brother said it was your cousin and him and you. So you don't rap what you did, you just rap what you knew. Don't be ashamed, there's plenty niggas that do what you do. There's no malice in your heart, you an approachable dude. Man, you might have sold the college kids for Nike and Mercedes, but you act like you sold drugs for Escobar in the 80s. I had a microphone of yours, but then the signature faded. I think that pretty much resembles...
And Pusha's response was the story of Adnan.
Sophie knows better as your baby mother. Cleaned her up for IG, but the stench is on her. A baby's involved, it's deeper than rap. We talking character, let me keep with the facts. You are hiding a child, let that boy come home. Deadbeat motherfucker playing border patrol. Ooh! Adonis is your son.
Good lord. So, just to take a step back, let's situate... This is a very interesting battle because of where Drake and where Pusha T kind of stand in the pantheon of rap. Who wants to take that and kind of just kind of break down for people who might not be following it as closely, like what they kind of stand for? Because it's very different things.
Right. Well, Drake is a pop star. He's arguably the biggest rapper out right now. Incredibly popular. His streaming numbers are off the charts. Pusha is, as Brendan said, a rapper's rapper, someone who is respected for his lyricism, his skills, not necessarily for his sales. That's not what he's about. So they represent sort of two deeply opposed camps in not just rap, but in music in general.
But Drake's thing is he wants it all. He could just kind of sit back and be a rapper who also sings and makes a lot of pop hits and isn't kind of going for the crown of greatest rapper, right, or street cred.
And every once in a while, Drake will emerge and be like, oh, I can rap, you know, as well as anyone, you know, in the traditional sense of what rapping was. And, you know, he gets good traction for it, but, you know, he also gets the accusations of ghostwriting and whatnot.
Well, my understanding is, so there's this guy, Quentin, who there's like demo tracks leaked of him doing Drake verses. And Drake doesn't deny that's, he says like Quentin helped him out a little bit, like basically, but he was helping Quentin by letting him write for him. But you know, that it's not like he actually denies it, right? It's just
And there's a long history of this in rap music to begin with.
Quentin Miller was a credited songwriter on that album.
Right.
He's getting royalties off of that. He's the Holland Dozier Holland of OVO.
And they already litigated this in the Meek Mill beef. That was like, Drake's had this come up before. It didn't stick then. That's not really the thing that's going to stick now.
No, it got a lot worse this time. It got a lot worse. So, I mean, Simon has pointed out when people, because someone said, you know, music journalism fell short. Like, basically, the music journalist should have dug up Drake's alleged child. Now, I don't buy that. Now, number one, if any music journalist, quote unquote, music journalist started digging into Drake's private life and tried to break the story of his child, they'd be like, you're not doing music journalism or even really journalism. You're being like a TMZ guy. Number one. Number two, as the other thing, as Simon and others pointed out, this was already out there, this rumor, you know.
Right. So the rumor about Drake and his possible unacknowledged child was in fact reported by tabloid reporters, by sites like TMZ and Bossip, which is sort of where it belongs. I think it's not a great look for an investigative reporter. It is a good look for a rapper who's engaged in a battle.
What Drake, to be clear, what Drake's people said at the time is he was not, they actually said this, they gave the statement, which is he was not convinced this child was his, but if he were to be convinced, he would do the right thing. But weirdly, people weren't paying enough attention. So when Pusha brought it up, and you know, and brought it up in a really brutal fashion. Adonis is your son. He deserves more than an Adidas press run. So people really kind of just took a step back. And then the other aspect was sort of extra musical, where he dug up this photo that turns out to be a real photo of Drake in blackface. Now, this appeared to be an art statement of some sort that Drake was making, right? He was trying that, or so he says that he was trying to make a statement. I guess it never came out. It wasn't like he was just, you know, donning blackface for fun, but it was, people were, I think, more stunned by that than almost even the kid thing, right?
Yeah, when I first saw it, I thought it was Photoshopped, and I was like, wow. But it turns out it was a real photo that Pusha dug up. Drake's statement on that was that he was an actor at the time trying to get roles and felt like he was being typecast, and this was like his big like artistic statement on how black actors are still typecast in, I guess, minstrelly roles. Pusha's response to that explanation was just like, you never talk about social issues. You never talk about anything related to the black community. Well, what was this statement about? Like, why would anyone care what your explanation is? You got famous since then and never made a statement like this since. But yeah, really shocking image to dig up. It was crazy that it was real. That was, I think, the big thing that everyone was so surprised by.
Pusha's statement was basically like, I'm not an internet baby. Like, I don't know how to use Photoshop. Like, I found this photo, you know. At the same time, he's apparently got the world's best photo researchers that, you know, digging this up. You know, the issue here now is whether, is it possible that Drake will decide that the better part of valor is to not respond? He's been advised as such by some
that would certainly
pretty
be
OG
the
people.
Smart move. That would certainly, I mean, there's, you know, there's no way, I can't fathom any way that you could recover from such a surgical, you know, micro attack, like just completely took him apart.
Well, so Drake brought up the name of Push's fiance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was Push's kind of rationale for, you cross the line, I'm gonna. The problem with, you know, if you're gonna keep crossing lines, is if he decides to respond with something that's just unfathomably offensive, like, where does it? It gets dangerous on a lot of levels. On sort of, you know, it just seems like not a good idea. I don't know.
I think it's over. Yeah. I think that Kanye tweeted that it's all love now, and I think that there have been conversations off record about where this goes. And I don't think that Drake releases another song. He has an album to put out. Pusha says he has more stuff. I think that a bigger problem in this for Drake is that there's not a whole lot to dig up about Pusha, and not a whole lot of people are aware of Pusha as like a celebrity. So there's not that much to respond with. He has so much more to lose than Pusha T does.
Well, his part of his original diss of Pusha was like, you were, while I acknowledge that you were a drug dealer, you were perhaps not as grimy a drug dealer as you claim to be. That was basically the crux of his attack.
Pusha T has nothing to lose. He raps about being a drug dealer. He's again, like a rapper's rapper. This is the most famous he has ever been. And it's because he eviscerated Drake and says that he can do it again if this continues.
The funny thing, people have always, the one kind of complaint about Push is like, could you please rap about something besides cocaine? And it's like, fine, I'll rap about Drake. and apparently that was all that was needed. But Push It is, part of what's happening is Push It, who was always, like you said, a rapper's rapper and a critic's favorite, but was, you know, kind of to a certain extent stayed that way. I mean, the Clips famously had horrendous troubles with Jive, their label, that impeded their career. So it's kind of ironic that at this point in his career, he's the biggest he's ever been, probably.
It's surprising. This is one of those things, like, we're now starting to see rappers in their 40s and each one is a new thing to rap. Like, we've just never had an old rapper a rapper in middle age, and Pusha T is just charting out a very interesting third act to his career right now.
There's no model for Jay-Z. There's no model for Eminem at this age. Like, it's not a luxury or it's not a challenge that, like, you know, Kool Moe Dee had to overcome.
We should actually hear the Clips' Grindin', which is such a great song, a Neptune's produced song from, I think, 2002.
From ghetto to ghetto, the backyard to yard, I sell it whip on whip, it's off the hard. I'm the neighborhood pusher, call me subwoofer, cause I pump bass like that jack.
Maybe just briefly talk about the legend of the Clips, because that was really, Chris, that I imagine that's territory for you.
Sure. I mean, you know, the Clips came out, produced by the Neptunes, worked with Pharrell and Chad before they were famous, and in Virginia Beach, and came out at the absolute peak of the Neptunes making weird sideways avant funk for the future, and they came out on top of that with these very baroque labyrinthine rhymes about selling cocaine. And the first record was really big in rap circles. The second record, once they changed labels, was really big in hipster circles. And Pusha has maintained this career that sort of careens in between those two worlds.
And then maybe we could talk about, we touched on Drake's desire to have it all, to also want to be seen as a great sort of rapper qua rapper, like just not just one of the biggest artists in the world. He really, and I find it admirable that he kind of doesn't, he's not satisfied with just his commercial success and his, and the sort of pop excellence of his music, that he also wants to push in that direction. Is this possibly the end of him kind of striving for that kind of recognition? I don't see that, because I think it's so core to what he wants. What do you think, Simon?
I think in some sense that ship has already sailed. I think early in Drake's career, he used to say that he was the greatest rapper, or he was going to be the greatest rapper a lot more often. Now it's more like just a little taste that he sprinkles into his raps. Most of the time he's talking about how great his life is, his love life, how rich he is, how successful he is.
Great/miserable, yes.
Right, but I think from this point onward, Drake is going to continue talking about how great it is to be Drake, how much he enjoys life, what a great popular entertainer he is, maybe complain about women in his life, and maybe a little less frequently, even less frequently, say that he's the greatest rapper, but I don't think he needs to anymore.
What do you think, Brennan?
I think that Drake's big Achilles heel is how much he pays attention to what everyone is saying about him. I think that another person in his position would not engage with someone like Pusha T, but Drake reads like all the rap blogs. Like, it's a very like well-documented thing. I think that's his big strength in a lot of ways, because he's up on the new stuff all the time. But it's also a weakness when he like decides that he needs to prove stuff to people who he's never going to prove that he's the best rapper alive. Like, it's just not really a thing that, like, the people that decide that are never going to go for Drake.
And at the same time, to be clear, like, he's really great at what he does.
Yeah,
like, you know, sure. and a great rapper. Like, not like he's a bad rapper either.
He's a really great rapper when he turns it on. I think that it's probably because he knows no one will consider him the best rapper alive that he wants that kind of distinction.
The distinction is that he has to turn it on, whereas Pusha T is it all the time.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, he's definitely...
Pusha T's entire career is like, watch me say this bugged out stuff, you know, watch me find this unique way to...
Yeah, Pusha's never had the versatility that Drake does. He's never honestly been interested in it, but I don't think that if Pusha one day was like, oh, I'm just gonna write a pop song, that it would go great.
It would not go great.
Drake can do both things, and I think he's split between what he wants. Obviously, the money will win out for him, I think.
He's certainly raised hackles with his attempts to claim the greatest rapper title. I mean, Kendrick made a point. When I interviewed Kendrick Lamar last year, he made a point of saying kind of elaborating on a lyric from his album, but that you can't call yourself the greatest rapper of all time or the greatest rapper out there and use a ghostwriter, which is pretty pointed. You know who he's talking about, among other people, although he was pretty careful not to be specific.
Right, but I think, you know, to the listener, it almost doesn't matter, right? Drake is the greatest rapper in the way that Frank Sinatra was the greatest singer. It's not about songwriting. It's about performance and presence, and he has that, I think, in terms of...
So he is the greatest rapper of all time.
I think there are different ways to measure who's great, and I think in terms of, you know, pop success, smoothness, Drake is on a level that even Kendrick is not quite on.
I think that's true. I think we, you know...
Yeah, we've changed our metric, you know, over the last 40 years. Like, the metric to decide this has changed.
Right.
And, you know, like guys like Pusha T, guys like Meek Mill, they still work in a model that would have worked in 1993.
Right. But I think the answer is both models can be great, right? I enjoyed listening to Pusha's record and Drake's record.
But there's also maybe a difference between, you know, it doesn't scan as well, maybe, but you could say the greatest hip-hop artist, you could try to go for that title. I think greatest rapper is a very specific thing, and I see what Kendrick's saying. And don't you
for
see
sure yeah. Definitely, if we're talking about, you know, lyrical depth and originality, obviously Kendrick beats almost anyone out there by a mile, but I think there, as we're saying, there are different metrics, different ways to be great.
It was pretty funny that Kendrick was up getting his Pulitzer Prize while this beef was going down like 40 flows below him. Like, he literally was up on a, like, the I don't know where, but like someplace with a lot of steps in Washington DC, like receiving his prize, and he's like, all right, you guys enjoy your beef.
Right.
Anyway, so you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. We've been talking about Pusha T and Drake, and we'll be right back with more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
We were talking about Pusha T and Drake. I thought we'd broaden it out and talk about some of our favorite / greatest hip hop beefs of the past, and there've been a lot of them. Do you have a favorite, Chris, or do you have one that seems emblematic? Because I'm sure you have a lot of favorites. Do you have one that helps set the template that you love, or what would you want to talk about there?
Well, you know, all my favorite diss tracks came out in the 80s and 90s, but I do think that it goes without saying that the Jay-Z Nas beef is the template that Pusha is using, where you sort of just slowly pick apart someone piece by piece and, you know, leave them hardly any chance to come back. Jay-Z really took apart Nas. Like, Jay-Z was the absolute, one of the most savage battle diss track creators of all time.
Well, pull back. Remind everyone how that particular, because that's a big one. We should spend
I don't even remember how it started. How did that one even start?
That was after another one where after years of sort of lingering hostilities and subliminal shots at each other throughout the 90s, it sort of finally boiled over in diss tracks in 2001.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was all based around being the best rapper in New York. Like, King of New York was, like, still, like, now that's not really a title anyone holds.
Yeah.
But back then it was a huge deal.
It was about being the successor to Biggie.
Yeah. Are you saying Tekashi 6ix9ine is not the King of New York right now?
No.
You know, but, you know, he even went in to sort of, you know, discuss how you would arrive at deciding who was the best. And he just, like, did, like, an album-by-album breakdown of Nas. Yes. Like, you know, like the Rolling Stone album guy version of Nas's catalog. And it was just absolutely ridiculous. And then, you know, Nas came back famously with Ether, a song.
Well, let's hear Jay's song, Takeover.
If you mob deep, I hold triggers to cruise. You little fuck, I got money stacks bigger than you. When I was pushing weight back in 88, you was a ballerina. I got the pictures, I seen you. Then you dropped Shook One, switch your demeanor. Well, we don't believe you. You need more people. Rockefeller students.
And then, yeah, so that spawned Ether. So go ahead.
Ether, which is now part of the vocabulary of rap music. The word ether, you know, means to savagely destroy and a beef battle. Ironically, it actually did not do that because then Jay-Z returned with Super Ugly, which is people are holding up as an example of maybe when an MC went too far in a diss battle.
Let's hear Ether for a minute.
Fuck with your soul like Ether. Will. Teach you the king, you know you. Not. Godson across the belly. Lose. I prove you lost already.
Brace yourself for the main event. Y'all impatiently waiting. It's like an AIDS test. What's the
and yes, yeah, Super Ugly. Super Ugly was the one that Jay-Z's mom made him apologize for, if
that
I'm
is,
correct.
That yeah. is correct, yeah. Yes. And, you know, I can definitely see Pusha T's mom maybe wanting to have him pay Drake a little phone call. But yeah, like, I mean, that was the model for major label rappers to just push it to the absolute end. And I think that's, you know, people, you know, like Brendan was saying, like, that and then the 50 Ja Rule beef were like the last times they really took them apart piece by piece like that. And people seemed really shocked at this Pusha thing just because it hasn't happened in so long.
Well, let's go back to the Takeover. And, you know, as you mentioned, there was like a mathematical degree to which he took him apart. You know, he named Nas's album and he said that's a one hot album every 10-year average, which is one of the, you know, truly one of the most brutal lines probably in the history of hip hop.
I mean, I can probably come up with a few. Yeah. if we want to talk about Luke Bustdown and JT Money releasing Pussy Ass Kid and Ho Ass Play, I think we can. But as far as like precise laser accuracy disses, that's really good.
And then Super Ugly, where did he cross the line there?
When he said he skeeted on on Nas's baby seat in the back of...
No, he left condoms on the baby seat.
Oh.
He skeeted in the Jeep generally.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
got it.
Possibly. It's unclear where the... Yeah,
yes.
So apparently Jay's mom was like
that's
disgusting.
That's too far.
Yeah, right. But it's important to bear that history in mind, right? When people say that Pusha went too far by bringing up Drake's, you know, alleged family ties, I think there's a long history of rappers saying really flagrant, you know, offensive, personally disrespectful things.
Absolutely.
In the middle of beef.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and you can find them, you know, morally indefensible. You can find them retrograde politically and not in lines with the prevailing political sentiment of the time, but it is how you win a beef a lot of times.
Something else I'll say about Jay-Z and Nas is that 6 or 7 years after that, Nas was signed to Jay-Z's label, recording albums with him. They were buddies.
Yeah, this is all water way, way, way under the bridge.
So,
yeah.
You know, we may see the day when Pusha and Drake make an album together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that'd be a great record, actually.
And in fact, come to think of it,
because this one went so far, that seems like the possibly the only real conclusion, actually.
Right. And at root, I mean, Drake is a Pusha fan. There's famously a mm-hmm. clip of him talking on MTV about buying an autographed microphone that Pusha had signed. He loved the clips growing up.
Which he actually references in this song, the autograph faded or whatever. Yeah. So, right. I mean, not to put too obvious a point on it, but I mean, there was a time when rap beef got really dangerous, famously. And so, I mean, it did unnerve me a little bit, the bloodthirsty way that people were like, I mean, obviously Drake doesn't have that type of personal history, but there's something a little ominous to me about people like being like, yeah, now he should say something even more insanely disrespectful. Let's see where this goes. I was like, you know, maybe don't egg this on too much.
There's an aspect to being a rap fan that's very similar to like watching sports or watching professional wrestling
in particular,
where you now have your teams. I think that obviously, especially in the 90s, like beef became like an actual real world, like ended in violence and death. I don't think that anyone believes that Pusha T and Drake are going to physically attack each other.
No, I don't think so. But it just, there's something about the rooting on that sometimes that makes me a little uncomfortable. They're just, people are like, yeah, now he should say something really crazy to Pusha T. It's like, well, maybe, you know, maybe that's why I think it's so like adult that they were, that certain people came in and were like, you know what, you maybe shouldn't respond. That's probably the smartest thing. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think ever since Pac and Big, like, I think that there has been a concerted effort to squash beef. And I think that, like, you know, there are reasons to squash beef and reasons to, you know, we can have good records and, but, you know, it doesn't need to last forever. I do love, the DJ Quick MC8 beef ended with Quick being like, maybe we could do a record someday if you you figure it out.
It's sort of like, feel free to call and write at any time, like Trump wrote to North Korea.
You know, and another thing I think is really important that no one has really talked about is the circuit of battle rap that has been going on for for years, but as a sort of organized sport for the last 15 years, and it doesn't get the type of publicity, or you know, none of these rappers who perform in these battles ever become recording artists that earn fame, but they are the absolute cutting edge in destroying their opponents.
Yeah, there's these two guys. There's like this thing that people are passing around that I think is from the circuit you're talking about, Jefferson Price versus Caustic. And one of the guys literally, and I think we'll play a little bit of that. One of the guys literally on stage in front of everyone exposes the guy for cheating on his fiance with no warning and says the name of the fiance and the name of the woman he cheated with. And you can see the shock and horror on the guy's face. And so this has gone viral as one of...
You're the exact motherfucker I hate. Acting like a cocky bastard, then go home to your fat fiance Carly after you just got done opening condom wrappers with that fucking bitch Holly Masters.
They say it's more disrespectful than any famous rap beef because he just ruined the guy's life, our life. And supposedly the wedding got called off and everything. Wow. So it turns out these two unknowns maybe but Brendan, what beefs of the past are close to your heart? What do you love?
I would say my era is a little bit past the Jay and Nas beef, but 50 Cent was the master of beefing with everyone, and kind of the last gasp for beefs to like still sell records.
And 50 Cent could end a career with a beef.
He ended several careers. Most famously, Ja Rule, who really had his run ended there. It's unclear, like 50 will take all the credit for that. That's probably not true. That's really how he made his name, was by calling out everyone that he could. And he's just the funniest rapper. He was really charming, even when he was saying all this stuff.
Well, the 50 thing was always, and Ja Rule thing was always fascinating to me, because 50 always struck me as more poppy than he would kind of acknowledge, that his debut was actually full of pop hooks that was actually directly competing in its way mm-hmm. with Ja Rule. And so, but it's like he occluded that by going so hard at Ja Rule while simultaneously taking his place on the charts. There's something really funny about that.
Yeah, it was a real strategic masterstroke, was kind of coming up as the street rapper, making fun of the pop rapper, and then his debut album, which could conceivably, it's like a gangster rap classic, but it's also like a straight up pop album.
Yeah, and it's funny that the limit of that, the limit of 50 Cent's posturing as, you know, the hardest gangster rapper out there is, was Kanye West's, you know, self-eviscerating personal diary, you know, when they went up and up against each other in 2007, and, you know, which obviously was the influence for Drake.
The thing about the 50 and Ja Beef that I find interesting is that now, with the benefit of hindsight and history, if you compare their track records, I'm not sure it's clear that 50 actually made more of an impact on history than Ja did. They both had a substantial number of hits. They both were super popular in their day. Neither of them is seen as one of the greatest rappers ever now.
I think you would also maybe find that a lot of Ja's hits have more replay value in 2018 than 50's. He was very much a product of his time. There's a reason he was as popular as he was, and there's a reason that that run ended.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. I think they're at least neck and neck in terms of long-term pop impact.
Neither of them were thinking that far ahead.
Right. This is reminding me of when I interviewed Ashanti around that time, and her quote to every question was basically like, yeah, it's bananas.
I mean, it was, in her defense.
And it was bananas. She had so many hits. It was bananas. I mean, she was right. Simon, what beefs are close to your heart?
Well, the Jay-Z and Nas beef is certainly one that's close to my heart as someone who was, you know, a high schooler in New York when that happened. It was really dramatic. One of my favorite individual diss tracks is Common's The Bitch In You, when he went to Ice Cube back in the 90s. This is long before Common was sort of the happy, smiley, friendly guy wearing a sweater who Starbucks goes to for their racial sensitivity training. Back when Common was mad, he went pretty personal and pretty hard against Ice Cube, and it's a classic song.
A bitch snigger with an attitude named Cube stepped to the con with a few. Now what the fuck I look like dissing a whole coast? You ain't made shit dope since America's Most Wanted to see from the Midwest to the East, on the dick of the East.
Yeah, that feels pretty incongruous, and also in theory feels unwise that Common would go after Ice Cube, but at the time I guess it made sense.
It made sense, it raised his profile at the time, and they did eventually squash that beef. Now they're both Hollywood actors.
Chris was going to go back and talk about sort of the beginning of rap beef. Where did it all start?
Well, you know, hip hop in general, since its earliest days, was a competitive art form, like based in this idea of competing crews, you know, jockeying for position. And, you know, it started with DJ battles and, you know, there were battles of breakdancing prowess. There were battles to see whose sound system was louder, you know, and it was all basically to decide who was the better crew. And then, you know, when emceeing came into the equation, there was, you know, you started seeing routines and you know, this kind of, you know, theatrical aspect to sort of, you know, carry this over. And people always point to the most iconic battle of the early days was Busy Bee versus Kool Moe Dee at the Christmas Rappers Convention. And I think that was the tail end of 81. It's 81 or 82. And, you know, you listen to it and, you know, Busy Bee comes out and completely rocks the crowd, you know, doing his, you know, his ba wa da ba bit that you may recognize years later in a particular Kid Rock song. You know, he does a fantastic job handling a crowd. And then Kool Moe Dee comes out and just destroys him and picks it apart and even, you know, says that he bought that that Ba Wa Da Ba stuff from Spoonie G. You know, this, you know, was traded on cassette tape and became like the legendary battle, like the legendary beef that would eventually prove, you know, the model and beef as a, you know, an important aspect of hip hop itself. And the it really started getting interesting once you started putting records in the equation and started putting economics in the equation, and records that you know, you could call out someone on a record and then sell that record and make money. And, you know, obviously you can watch right now on Netflix the great movie about Roxanne Shanté. You know, she was a teenager and wrote an Answer record in the great tradition of Answer records that goes back to, you know, the 50s and beyond. And, you know, basically tore apart UTFO and, you know, got her name dissing another group.
So let's hear Roxanne, Roxanne, which was the UTFO song.
Yo, EMD.
Yeah, what's up, man?
Think of that girl they call Roxanne. She's all stuck up.
Why you say fat?
Cause you wouldn't give a guy like me no rap. Man, she was walking down the street, so I said, hello, I'm Kango from UTFO.
And then let's hear Roxanne's Revenge.
I met this dude with the name of a hat. I didn't even walk away. I didn't give him no rap. But then he got real mad and he got a little tired. If he worked for me, you know he would be fired. His name is Kango.
What are some other ones of the 80s and 90s, some other rap pieces of the 80s and 90s?
Well, the biggest and most transformative, I feel, is the Bridge Wars of circa 86, 87. It was basically Boogie Down Productions who, you know, KRS-One was completely reinventing flow, completely, you know, reinventing the subject matter that rappers talk about. Versus the Juice Crew, who was like the funkiest, most, you know, they're super popular crew, which included MC Shan, Marley Marl, Roxanne Shanté. And, you know, MC Shan dropped The Bridge and, you know, where he basically, you know, just talked about how much he loved hearing hip hop growing up in his native Queensbridge, and KRS took that as a piece of revisionist history, uprooting you know, hip hop's origins in the Bronx, and just started writing these savage diss tracks, you know, where he not only, you know, went after MC Shan, he went after, you know, people in his posse one by one. He, you know, laid out a history lesson for anyone who didn't know about the Bronx. And it's like, you know, to, you know, rap music was just getting out to places outside of New York and LA. And so it's like, he not only destroyed, I mean, he didn't, you know, not, you know, he not only went after the Juice Crew, but he provided that context for, you know, a ton of teenagers who didn't know the history.
And let's hear MC Shan's The Bridge.
You love to hear the story again and again of how it all got started way back when. The monument is right in your face. Sit and listen for a while to the name of the place.
The Bridge.
And then the bridge is over. Was actually the, I think, the second Boogie Down Productions.
Yeah, first one was South Bronx.
So let's hear South Bronx.
So you think that hip hop had its start out in Queensbridge? If you pop that junk up in the Bronx, you might not live, cause you're in
South Bronx. South.
And now it's here, the bridge is over.
If you want to join the crew, well, you must see me. You can't sound like Shan or the one Marley. Because Shan and Marley Marl and my rhyming like the gay. Picking up the mic, my name don't know
and
what so, to say.
And well, and it continued because then, you know, Roxanne Shanté did Have a Nice Day. MC Shan did Kill That Noise. And these are all like great rap records in addition to just being, you know, beef. Like, you know, like the, you know, the Pusha thing is a clever piece of rap writing, but these were records. These were marketed as, you know, 12-inch singles that you had to buy. And the economy became such that there were like, there was a whole economy of Answer records to the Answer records, especially with the Roxanne Wars. There were so many, you know, Fly By Night Roxanne records, you know, Roxanne's a Man and Roxanne's Doctor, and, you know, even, you know, MC Mishki's Brooklyn Blew Up the Bridge. And, you know, this whole like shadow economy of rap records getting onto this, to these diss records. And it's just like, it created this like such a vibrant, you know, discussion and world before we started using words like meme.
When did things start getting really intense? Was Ice Cube versus NWA the first like really, really intense thing where it felt really fraught with, you know, potential violence or potential whatever?
I mean, I would say that, you know, the Ice Cube thing, when Ice Cube went after NWA, I think he was more pilloried for the use of, you know, anti-Semitism and homophobia, which all of which added to the intensity of his disses. I don't know if anyone actually thought it would come to violence. I think the first time, you know, the earliest that I can think of a diss track where you hear it and you're like, wow, man, this guy really shouldn't be fucking saying this, is Tim Dog's Fuck Compton. And an absolute amazing track.
Let's hear a little bit of that.
Let's get right down to the nitty gritty and talk about a bullshit city. Talking about niggas from Compton. They're no company, truly ain't stomping. Tim Dog, a black man's past.
Absolutely amazing track. You know, a complete left hook from New York City that ended up, you know, spawning songs that would be on The Chronic and, you know, Dr. Dre's, you know, tectonic shifting The Chronic. And that's a good example of something that feels like it went too far. And obviously, Tupac was an absolute master of going too far. Hit Him Up, his diss track with Biggie, begins with "I fucked your bitch, you fat motherfucker," and ends with him
again, not nice,
and ends with him, you know, making fun of Prodigy from Mobb Deep, making fun of his sickle cell. You know, it's vicious, venomous stuff, and it did, you know, ultimately, whether tied to those to that beef or not, ultimately ended in violence. Though, you know, the exact causes are certainly disputed, but, you know, that is the moment that, you know, people were like, okay, this needs to stay on wax. This cannot leave the recording booth.
Do you share my fondness for LL Cool J as a battle rapper?
Oh man, amazing. Jack the Ripper was amazing. You know, and a B-side to Going Back to Cali was him just destroying Kool Moe Dee, a legend in his time. And, you know, LL Cool J's entire persona was just basically battle rapping the world. And, you know, that is a phenomenal thing.
His battle with cannabis is, you know, a great example of a battle like actually destroying one of the people in the battle. I mean, he destroyed cannabis. Cannabis was like never heard from again.
I kind of disagree with that. I mean, I didn't, and not about cannabis never being, you know, I think the beats on the cannabis record helped destroy cannabis. But, you know, cannabis's attack on LL for that one, I feel, was the pinnacle in that he got LL's friend Mike Tyson to be on the record, and you know, like really, you know, and it's almost like a Pusha T Drake situation in that at the time, like LL was Hey Lover, he was this kind of he was crossing over into this R&B territory, and here comes Cannabis, a rapper's rapper, if there ever was one, and you know, just going after his new fan base, going after the, you know, the fact that women listen to LL Cool J's music.
So the name of the cannabis track that we should hear is not 4-3-2-1.
Second round KO.
So let's hear Second Round KO.
You walk around showing off your body cause it sells, plus to avoid the fact that you ain't got scales. Mad at me cause I kick that shit real, niggas fail. Why 99% of your fans wear high heels? From Ice-T to Kool Moe Dee to Jay-Z, now you wanna fuck with me? You must be crazy. You dripping with whack juice and you can't get it off. You better.
And then, you know, to me, the moment when I would argue that he destroyed cannabis was with the line 99, because cannabis had suggested that all his fans were women.
Yeah, so 99% of your fans wear high heels.
And then, so he said 99% of your fans don't exist.
That's correct.
Which is pretty definitive.
Yeah, that's a good knockout blow from Cool James.
But apparently, LL's recently said that he wants to work with cannabis, but first you have to find him.
But you know, like and it's like, at the time, like, that was such a fun beef because, you know, we were just after you know, Biggie's death was 97. This was 98, where it was like, oh, this is what it's about. These guys are just going to keep it on record. You know, these guys are going to do this in you know, this classic way. And it's like a refreshing way to hear that. I still think it's like one of the most, you know, it's definitely one of the all-time best beefs.
Right. It showed that, because there could have been a world in which after that happened, hip hop beef could have itself sort of died because it seemed too risky, and that immediately showed it could return to its old way of doing it.
Yes.
But all right, any final thoughts on hip hop beefs, guys? Are we good?
I really wish I can shout out my favorite beef line in history.
Do it.
So yeah, my favorite beef line of all time is DJ Quick's Dollars Sense, where he goes after MC8. And this is such a beautiful, precise, masterful line. Giving your set a bad name with your misspelled name, E-I-H-T. Now, should I continue? Yeah, you left out the G because the G ain't in you.
Brutal.
So, on that note, this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and I had Chris Weingarten, Brendan Klinkenberg, and Simon Vosick-Levinson in the studio. Thanks for being here. And we'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to us as a podcast. Maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes if you liked it, or leave a mean review. I read them all. And thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker. Although I didn't really work with her a lot. But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a three-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.